The following program may not be suitable for all listeners. Please be advised that the content of this show includes discussion of sexual assault. Sensitive listeners are advised to tune out during this time.
From KDNK Community Access Radio in Carbondale, Colorado, in the United States, this is program number 61 of the Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. When blind people go places, they don't experience things like our sighted friends. We don't see beautiful mountains or romantic sunsets. The goal of this program is to identify and even create experiences that are more meaningful or just more fun for us and our sighted traveling companions. Frequently, as people lose their eyesight, they become more and more isolated. The Tactile Traveler hopes to empower people not only to go literally around the world, but around the block to new adventures in their lives. Blind ranges from people who are visually impaired, and glasses and contact lenses no longer allow them to live a normal life, to people like me, who are totally blind, to sighted parents who have a blind child, blind parents who have sighted children, blind parents with blind children, and people of all ages, interests, and physical abilities. On today's program, there's help for potential sexual predators before they break the law and mess up other people's lives and their own. And white cane skills for guide dog users. The following story is about preventing sexual assault and may not be suitable for all listeners. About 30 years ago, I was covering State District Court here in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, when the population of Garfield County was only about 40,000 people. And in one afternoon, I covered three different cases of men sexually assaulting children. I realized that waiting for when a child or adult is sexually assaulted is too late, and that something needed to be done. After a lot of research, I found that Carolyn Sonda, a therapist in Grand Junction, Colorado, who had a practice treating sexual offenders, also treated people before they broke the law and messed up their lives and the lives of potential victims. She said people even say things to people like their wives, "I'm starting to find little kids sexually attractive." Carolyn said instead of hearing their cries for help, they'd say things like, "You've been working too hard. You need to take a vacation." I realized how important Carolyn Sonda's therapy was. But when I tried selling stories on that there is help for potential sexual offenders before they broke the law, no one wanted to hear it. Blind people, like everyone else, are both victims and perpetrators of sexual assault, which has been in the news for the last couple of years. So I decided it was time to do this story. There have been some positive changes in the last 30 years. Ron Winstanley liked what Carolyn Sonda was doing and became partners with her about 14 years ago when Carolyn was in her 70s and he was in his 40s. They worked together for 5 years until she retired and he was ready to carry on the practice.
The evolution of this process was that Sex Offender Management Board was formed in the early 1990s. It is a government run Colorado agency that oversees men and women who have committed sexual offenses. In order to be under their purview, they have to have a charge and a conviction, and there was no real place for anybody to go that started to have these urges or these thoughts of either being sexually interested in children or having fantasies or ideas about rape. And the advice that was given to Carolyn and was given to me way back in the day was that you can't do anything until there's a conviction. So kind of passively waiting for somebody to get hurt so that we could have an intervention or some kind of a reaction. Carolyn and I didn't believe that that was the moral thing to do. We don't think it's the ethical thing to do.
Jacqueline Shepherd is a therapist who treats both sexual offenders and potential offenders in Tucson, Arizona. She said thinking about sexual assaults and the actual acts are coping mechanisms for dealing with stress.
A lot of it begins because of access to pornography. These individuals, in order to cope with everyday stressors, including stressors that are triggers from the past, in order to cope with the situation, they will turn to a coping mechanism. They'll self-medicate through the use of pornography or the use of sexual thought or fantasy. So that would be a coping mechanism. Any individual that has sexual thoughts or fantasies, masturbates to it, or looks at pornography for the purpose of masturbation, or if they practice any of the pedophilic behaviors like voyeurism, all of it is a coping mechanism. So you treat the coping mechanism. If this is what they do in order to relieve themselves from stress, anxiety, depression, loneliness, you have to replace the coping mechanism. And nothing beats the level of dopamine they get from sexual transgression. So that is a really difficult therapy to treat, because having sex or having sexual thoughts is one of most often everybody's favorite way of feeling better. Let's say we have Jimmy. I'm making a name up. Jimmy was exposed to pornography since the age of 7, and ever since then, he really enjoys pornography. And every week until the age of 22, he would look at pornography and masturbate to it. And when he'd have a bad day, he'd masturbate to pornography. Then he broke up with his girlfriend. Now he's masturbating all the time to pornography. And then Jimmy decides online that whatever he's looking at pornography-wise isn't enough. I don't want traditional vanilla pornography. I now want to see bondage, or I want to see fantasy rape. So now this individual likes the level of violence and aggression displayed in the pornography. But Jimmy is now working a 10 to 12 hour shift for the last month, and he hasn't had immediate access to his pornography of rape or fantasy rape for quite some time. So in order for Jimmy to be able to get his dopamine fix, be able to feel good, he doesn't have access to pornography. He might think about it or fantasize it about work. So if he's fantasizing and thinking about these rape acts from pornography, and he sees himself in the act, then he is now getting closer to allowing the fantasy. If we allow a thought to thrive in our head, we are more likely to act on that thought. So now that Jimmy has been having these sexual thoughts and fantasies that have increased in intensity, violence, aggression, and non-consent, now Jimmy gets fired from work. And he has been thinking and fantasizing about his neighbor for weeks at this point. He can and might act on it. So that's how it happens. Nobody just snaps. That doesn't exist. Nobody does that. That means that the thought and fantasy had been in there for a while. And when somebody snaps, it means that they removed every barrier that they had in order to act on it, in order to meet the need. The need becomes greater than their concern or risk for themselves.
Jacqueline says the next step is what she calls sexual objectification.
My definition of sexual objectification as a clinical therapist, it means that I have determined the value of another based on my needs. So if I find somebody's lips attractive, the lips is an oral feature of the body. It is sexual in nature. So is the anus, the vagina. So if, let's say, I decide that a man at a gas station pump, that his lips are desirable, then I have sexually objectified him. That means that I've determined that his aesthetic value to me is worth his lips. And so what happens is, if we determine somebody's value based on the parts instead of the whole of them, we begin to sexually objectify them depending on the parts of the body. So if I enjoy seeing somebody's buttocks, then that is sexual in nature. Now, in that sexual objectification, if I like looking at somebody's buttocks, then I might develop a thought or fantasy in my head. Wow, those person's buttocks are shapely. I like those. Now that I've sexually objectified them, what am I going to do with that information in my mind? And these individuals often will turn those thoughts into a sexual fantasy. And then if that sexual fantasy continues, it can turn into action. So sexual fantasies create dopamine in the system along with other chemicals that feel good. And those chemicals are going to impact the groin region, arousal. And arousal in most male individuals happen in the groin and they happen in the mind. So those two areas are being activated and then they're being rewarded by that activity through a dopamine release. So why would I stop doing something that makes me feel good? And that's what tends to happen. They're going to keep acting upon those thoughts because it creates a good release for them, a very high amount of dopamine surge, because sex usually does that, and anything related to sex. And now it's really difficult to tell somebody, hey, you can't have sexual thoughts or fantasies because you crossed the line. You can't trust yourself to manage your behaviors anymore because you continue to cross the line. And that is the model for addiction, especially drinking. That individual can no longer drink because they will cross the line every time.
Jacqueline says their sexual thoughts and urges are an addiction. It should be treated that way.
They'll have to minimize their risk reduction. So if this individual has an attraction to minors, let's say between the ages of 7 and 9, prepubescent males most specifically, this individual would have to go through extreme treatment regarding their proximity, their contact, and their belief system. Do they have a criminal mentality? Do they believe that they have a right to have a relationship with that population? Do they understand the harm that they cause? Do they understand the sense of victimization of that population? And oftentimes they find themselves victimized.
There's a term used in the field of sexual therapy called MAPS, M-A-P. It means minor attracted persons. Minor as in minors or as in children. Jacqueline Shepherd is considered conservative in her practice, and they don't use the term MAP because it may normalize or destigmatize harmful behavior. A person who does use the term is Brandon Galepsky. He is moderator of the MAP Support Club. Through an email interview, he said, the MAP Support Club is a chat-based peer support group for people age 13 and over who experience attraction to children. We also have allied clinicians who interact in certain channels. The MAP Support Club was started by a man who went by the name Ender. Ender was a moderator at another support group called VerPet, but was frustrated that the minor MAPs who were writing him and were asking for help couldn't get it, since VerPet had an 18-plus rule. The MAP Support Club is needed because while there are few places for anti-contact pedophiles to seek support, there are even fewer places for minor MAPs to seek support. The MAP Support Club is the only such place to my knowledge. Discovering that you're a MAP as a teen is confusing, shameful, terrifying, and depressing at an already confusing time of life. It's further complicated by an attraction that society tells you you should kill yourself for. Many minor MAPs do just that. Others turn to substance abuse, self-harm, risky behavior, or acting out. The MAP Support Club is a place that can help MAP teens navigate this times of their life and go on to live healthy, happy, non-offending lives. They can be reached at mapsupport.club. That's mapsupport.club. Another source of help is Stop It Now. Jenny Coleman is Stop It Now's director.
We run free and confidential helpline for anybody at all who has questions or concerns about child sex abuse. The helpline was originally started to reach people. They themselves were saying, I think that I could be somebody who's at risk. I think about children sexually, or I fantasize about children sexually. I may have crossed some boundaries. We also hear from people who have crossed boundaries. They've downloaded child sexual abuse material. They may have even abused a child. So we speak with anyone and everyone and help them identify resources, more information. And often just our conversation style is a model that's rooted in that strength-based, that is designed to help folks identify what might be in their way for asking for help and how can we then clear the path for them, whether it's because they need information, because they felt isolated or shame, because they just needed, you know, somebody to be encouraging to them, to get them to take the next step, ask for help live and in person with a professional in their community.
Denny says when you call the hotline, you'll be treated with respect.
Help really has to include respect, non-judgment. People who struggle with thoughts and feelings sexually about children are not monsters, that they can be helped, that we don't want to just make assumptions that because somebody is worried about what they're thinking about, that they're a bad person. So the most important thing for me is that people know that people ask for help and how important it is that we make sure that they have it. I mean, we obviously don't want anybody to abuse, but we're not here to sit and judge and jury. What we're here to do is to help somebody feel supported. We know that isolation and shame is like water on the seat of child sex abuse. And so what help looks like for us is to make sure that nobody has to feel like they have to go through it alone and that they have hope that they can be in control of their life and their behaviors, and that they even have hope that they can have a future that is joyful and healthy and safe.
Jenny says Stop It Now has an additional website for teenagers and young adults.
In addition to Stop It Now's helpline, 5 years ago, we opened up another program called What's OK, WHATSOK.org. And this is a helpline for youth ages 14 to 22 who are also asking questions about what safe sexual behaviors are. The website and the helpline doesn't say specifically that we're there to protect children and prevent child sex abuse, but it is still the same objective by getting youth, teenagers, accurate information early about safe sexual behaviors, how they can plan for their own safety and for the safety of others.
Jenny says Stop It Now is a good place to start when faced with sexual abuse or potential sexual abuse.
We don't as much refer them because we're national, so we can't maintain a national database of therapists, but we have relationships with organizations that do have that information, such as the Association for the Treatment and Prevention of Child Sex Abuse, the Association for the Treatment and Prevention of Sex Abuse, and also Safer Society. These are two organizations that we respect that have databases of therapists who specialize in sexual problematic behavior. Expect for our resource to be, you know, the only thing that helps, but that can be one of the steps in terms of somebody addressing their behaviors. Another most important thing is just for everybody to recognize that they can roll, that by learning how to have conversations around safety planning, when you have concerns about somebody's behavior, that when you talk to children about healthy sexuality and development, these are all parts of prevention planning. And so there's a role for all of us in how we can help children, how we can help adults in our lives, and how we can help ourselves.
Stop It Now's phone number is 1-888-PREVENT, which is 1-888-77368. That's 888-773-8368. Stop It Now also has a website, stopitnow.org. In summary, there's help for people who find children sexually attractive or have urges to sexually assault adults. Before they act on those urges and mess up the lives of victims and their own lives. If someone important to you asks for help, either directly or indirectly, refer them to the Help It Now helpline. Help is similar to addiction therapy. Thinking about sexually assaulting children or adults or acting on those thoughts are coping mechanisms for dealing with stress. Stop It Now's 24-hour helpline is 888-PREVENT. Help It Now's website is helpitnow.org. And their webpage for young people is whatsok.org. And then the Minor Attracted Persons support group is mapsupport.club. Christina Hart, Jim Stokes, and Ryan from the Denver, Colorado Public Library Resource Department helped with this story. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. There's a big difference for a blind person between traveling with a white cane or using a guide dog. A guide dog guides you from point to point with appropriate stops for curbs, intersections, and things like stairs. It will go around obstacles like cars sticking out of driveways into sidewalks and even low-hanging tree limbs, so you arrive at your destination quickly and safely without a lot of information on how you got there. White cane users have a totally different experience. Unlike in the movies, where blind people tap their canes from side to side, most cane users use what is called constant contact. They move their cane about shoulder width from side to side, keeping their cane tip on the ground or floors. As a result, they're very aware of their environment. I have a friend who used a guide dog for years and never realized that the part of her driveway went from her sidewalk downhill to the street because her guide dog never went down that part of her driveway. Most guide dog schools require that candidates for guide dogs need to be proficient in using white canes to be eligible to receive a guide dog, because white cane skills require knowing where you're at and where you're going. Alyssa Otis is the outreach specialist and a mobility instructor at Leader Dogs for the Blind in Rochester Hills, Michigan. She says it shouldn't be either or, a guide dog or a white cane.
In the past, what we used to say is, once you get that guide dog, you can fold up your cane and put it in the closet and you never have to use it again. Well, what we have found out is that is so incorrect. There is always a time and a need to use your white cane. So in order to be successful with a guide dog, because a guide dog is not just a GPS, you can't pick up that harness handle and tell the dog forward, find Starbucks. They're not going to know where Starbucks is. So it's up to the handler, the person that's working with the dog, to know how to get from point A to point B. And then the dog is going to help them get there safely. It's also important that they are able to read intersections, because our dogs don't read traffic lights and know when it's safe to cross. All of these skills are super important to have and to be an independent traveler in order for you to be successful when we do actually get a dog in your hands. And then we always suggest that you maintain those skills with your white cane, because A, what if something does happen to your dog? What if your dog gets sick and you need to go somewhere without your dog? What if maybe you want to take a vacation and not bring the dog? Or if you're going to a rock concert, or if you want to go to Disney and you don't feel like taking your dog. So maintaining those skills is super important. Also, we understand that people's vision is always changing and the environment is always changing. So again, another reason to really keep up those white cane skills. You never really graduate from orientation and mobility training.
Alyssa says that guide dog users should be using their white cane as part of a weekly routine.
There's not a specific number of times. I would say, you know, taking it out at least once a week is a good amount, but the more you can do it, the better. At least get out once a week with your white cane and go somewhere, travel somewhere, even if it is just up to the post office and back, just to maintain those skills that you have.
You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. Why It's my talking scale, reminding us that we'd like you to weigh in on how we're doing. Please let us know by sending an email to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. We spell traveler the American way with one L. We'd also like to hear your story ideas from all over the world. Please send us an email with story ideas in the subject line to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. Transcripts of this program are available for our deaf listeners by searching The Tactile Traveler in any search engine. This program is also being broadcast on AfterSight, formerly the Audio Information Network of Colorado, and audio information networks in additional states. It's also available by typing The Tactile Traveler into any search engine and available wherever you get podcasts, and by asking your smart speaker to play the podcast, The Tactile Traveler. We'd like to thank the following people and organizations that help make today's program possible. Be My Eyes, Microsoft Accessibility Tech Support, Apple Accessibility Tech Support, Leslie Steffens, Pat Conero, Lorraine Hutchinson, Debbie O'Leary, Sarah Williams, Sophia Williams, Hope Amu, Kaylee Romero, and Raleigh Burley. This has been The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low-vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. This is a production of KDNK Community Access Radio, Carbondale, Colorado.